You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 7th of February 2015 on Monocle 24. Introducing new artists, celebrating legends of past eras, the performers, players and theory behind the lyrics. Like music itself, the magazines dedicated to telling its story come in all different shapes and sizes and tones. Delve into a stack of magazines with a unique soundtrack here today on a musical edition of The Stack. This week on The Stack, we're all in tune with a selection of the journals, zines, papers and magazines dedicated to writing about and reporting on music. The musical press has long inspired passion and rage at times like few other sectors. We'll be discussing music journalism, critical theory and how contemporary musicians operate with The Wire's editor-in-chief Tony Herrington. And Monocle's contributing editor and longtime scribe of the scene, Andrew Muller, joins us too to shed a little light on how the musical press could make or break rock and pop stars back in the day. We'll also hear from a pop icon of the 80s whose face graced the covers of magazines all over the world, Toya Wilcox.
You needed magazine culture back then. There was the fanzine culture, as well as the culture of music magazines, which had incredible power. You had to be reviewed by music magazines to be on the map as an artist.
All that and plenty more besides on this music magazine edition of The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis programme. Hello and welcome to The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. We're talking music magazines past and present this week. With me are a couple of, I'll call them legends. As editor-in-chief of The Wire magazine for over 10 years, Tony Herrington has well and truly earned his reputation as a purveyor of critical music journalism that proves there's a thriving market for a proper independent monthly music magazine. And with his unique insights into music culture and giving us the unabridged version of the life of a music journalist through the last couple of decades, we have Monocle's contributing editor and music writer Andrew Muller. Gents, welcome both to The Stack. Tony Herrington, perhaps I'll start with you. A lot of people obviously suggest that, you know, it's a dark, if not a dark day, a bit of a dark era almost for the music presses. We talk, of course, about the digital onslaught and all this kind of thing quite often on The Stack. As a practitioner and, you know, someone who helms one, you know, really a great title in this marketplace, do you feel you're battling a bit against the tide, or is there reason to be much more optimistic than that, do you think?
I mean, obviously what you're alluding to, I think, is, you know, the sort of the onslaught of the digital revolution, digital technology, online content, free content online and so on and so forth. I mean, you can look at it as either a threat or you can look at it as an asset or a possibility, which publishers can use to both broadcast and extend their activities to an ever wider sort of readership or potential readership and so on and so forth. And I think most small publishers, even though they may give the impression that they're sort of screaming, running to the hills, or like lemmings over a cliff or something, I think most of them, if they've got imagination, if they're kind of up for a challenge, then they're basically really welcome the sort of the opportunities that online culture, the internet, social media, and so on and so forth bring to what they do. And I think for The Wire, certainly, that's an attitude that we've taken ever since email came along. Likewise, all the sort of online technologies that have come online in the last, 10 to 15 years, we've tried to sort of do the same thing there, you know, embrace them, whether it's, you know, launching websites, going on social media, and rather than looking at those things as being a sort of a threat to the potential sales or viability of the print edition of the magazine, see them as something which we can sort of bolt onto the print magazine, which we can gives us opportunities as a company and as a publisher and organization to do things that print media doesn't allow us to do.
And, so the print offer is very much still at the heart of what you do. Andrew, I mean, it was interesting, Tony sort of alluded there to this idea of, you know, the original voices. Do you still feel that, you know, if you've got an original voice, if you've got something to say and you can say it well, there's still the outlets there. The great bits of music writing will still appear as they always have done, or are you slightly more, I don't know, sceptical about it?
I'm very sceptical about that. All the obvious things about the decline of the music press and the reasons for it have been said. And they're all entirely accurate. That's why people keep saying them. What it has had to me a noticeable effect on is the actual now quality of what's being printed by such music press as still exists. I mean, I have a very, very sentimental attachment to this because when I was growing up in Australia, especially in the late 80s, reading the music weeklies out of London, the NME and Melody Maker in particular, both of which I went on to work for. So I'm able to say that literally changed my life. It was what made me decide that what I wanted to do for a living was write, ideally about music and perhaps about other things. For various reasons, those kind of magazines don't exist anymore. I grant that I'm saying this as somebody who's more than twice the age he was then, and I shouldn't understand what, you know, the kids are now reading. But I'm reasonably sure that if the sort of equivalent of the 18, 19-year-old me was reading something like the NME as it still is, it can't possibly have been inspiring in the same way. The lack of budgets has resulted in a lack of confidence, and that's resulted in a lack of ambition. There's almost no dissenting or critical voice anymore. It's rare to read a critical or even, as used to be the old school, violently abusive review of a major release anymore. It just, especially not, certainly not an established magazine, it just doesn't happen. So yeah, I think the opportunities for genuinely great writing about music are evaporating, certainly in print. There's some exceptions online, but really not very many.
Tony, do you think that's right? I mean, this idea of having to be necessarily more cautious, are you mindful of that, you know, working in a title that is, you know, known perhaps for being a bit more original in its thinking? Do you worry that this idea of caution that's forced upon you because of budgetary constraints is always there?
Well, I agree with Andrew when he says that there's a palpable lack of ambition. I think that applies certainly to the kind of magazines or publishers that he was referring to, which you might call mainstream newsstand publications. You know, you mentioned the NME, but obviously the sort of Melody Maker and all their sort of descendants in today, you'd be talking about Mojo and Uncut and so on. I think there's a palpable lack of ambition amongst those titles, and it seems to be driven by a fear factor in that they think if they alienate readers by not giving them what they think their readers want, then their readers will leave in droves because they don't need them anymore because there's so many other alternatives out there. But actually, I think that is either sort of takes readers for granted or actually kind of, you know, assumes that they are not particularly intelligent or robust enough to sort of stand, you know, reading stuff that they may not immediately want to read or immediately agree with. So I think there's a failure of ambition amongst those kind of publishers, you know, the EMAPs, the IPCs and so on, which, let's face it, is coming from the boardroom on down. It's not the editorial staff, many of whom I actually are personally acquainted with and who I know whose interests are still driven by a burning passion, which would have been at least as strong as anything that, say, the staff members of the NME or the Melody Maker were sort of characterised those kind of people in the late 80s or the late 70s and early 80s. So yeah, I agree with that completely. It is a lack of ambition, and I think it really kind of hampers those kind of magazines, those kind of publishers, those kind of organisations from actually producing really kind of vibrant, provocative copy, layouts, journalism and so on and so forth. I don't think it's a budgetary thing. You know, you can basically, there are ways and means of making things happen. I don't mean paying people nothing. You know, it's important to pay people for the work they do, and The Wire certainly has a policy of doing that. But I think it's also dangerous, you know, to talk about the music media as a kind of this massive homogenous thing. You know, the rules that apply to maybe Mojo, it's easy for me to say Mojo lacks ambition, but the you know, the sort of the things that apply to Mojo don't apply to The Wire. The Wire is a small independent company owned by the people that produce it. You know, Mojo is part of a massive media organization, and its overheads, the necessity of Mojo to turn a certain profit will be very, very, you know, the pressure down on them to do that will be very strong. And so that breeds a climate where people are scared to take risks.
You're right, but it does get driven by commercial reality. And what has changed in the last 20 years certainly was that at Melody Maker, I don't recall us ever taking any notice of anything anybody in marketing or advertising ever said to us, or if indeed they even tried to say anything to us, because there wasn't any reason to.
They were too intimidated by you.
Well, no, they weren't intimidated. In fact, I can't really, casting my recollection back of the sort of various dishevelled basket cases that populated the office, I cannot imagine a less intimidating array of humanity. But the thing was, there was no concern at all about us alienating, especially advertisers, because there was nowhere else for them to go. If they wanted to advertise to the sort of people who read Melody Maker, they had to advertise in Melody Maker. So even if we took again their latest new release, and even if they did get terribly upset with us, they'd be back next week. Where else were they going to go?
Tony, just a brief thought on this before we delve into our stacks of magazines a little later. Are you sort of aware then of a, I don't know if you'd call it a wider responsibility to sort of, you know, give great writing a break or to find really original, fresh voices? Is that part of the consideration that you make on an editorial basis, or are you just looking at things like, is this a great story? Is this a piece that I'd want to read?
Certainly, I think music and music literature or music journalism is less central to youth culture than it once was, because there are many, many other things there now, whether it's gaming or any other kind of pursuit that people can use as a way of expressing themselves, or, you know, getting their own ideas out into the world through these forms, whether it's writing about games or anything like that. So music journalism is probably less central than it was. It's less sexy, it's less so for that reason it's less likely to attract writers in the droves or the numbers that it used to, but obviously also, you know, it's less profitable, if it was ever profitable, actually, having said that. But, you know, back in the mid-2000s, you know, there were lots of blogs coming online at the time, so there was lots of interesting new young writers basically writing free-form in blogs, you know, and we tried to bring a lot of them into the wire. And what was interesting was that as soon as they sort of got onto the printed page, it was like they seemed to be like rabbits caught in the headlights, and it was very difficult to bring people from the blogosphere into print. It was really interesting and really frustrating for a long time. I mean, we're still very keen on bringing writers through. We bring new writers through. We don't really care about a writer's pedigree. If they have been published nowhere, it doesn't matter. If they write to us and they obviously have got something going on, they've obviously they've got some ideas and they have the sort of courage to express those ideas regardless, then absolutely we'll bring them in. And I do think, you know, I would say this, but I do think The Wire is quite high quality in terms of its own history now, in terms of the kind of writing that we're publishing across the board. It's a very high quality. And that's not because we have, you know, veteran writers like David Stubbs or Simon Reynolds or Ian Penman or David Toop, all of whom do write for The Wire. But it's because we've got young writers coming in, you know, men and women, who are interested in writing about music, trying to understand it both in the here and now and historically, which is very encouraging, you know, for me. And so that bodes well for the future in terms of just the quality of journalism, I hope. And these writers, you see it elsewhere too, you know.
Well, we'll talk a bit more about some of the kind of evolution we've seen in this sector. We've got some stacks of magazines. We'll look at how they've changed and what my guests Andrew Muller and Tony Harrington make of it, as well as hearing from a bit of an icon of the 80s music scene, another alongside my guest today, of course, when we come back after this.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
You're listening to The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. Now, in the late 1970s and early 80s, the punk scene was fodder for an emerging generation of great writers, photographers and documentary makers. The young stars of the scene, especially in hubs like London, where communities of punks and artists were working and often living together, were naturally the focus of much of the great work that appeared inside and on the covers of the music press at the time. One of those regular cover stars was Toya Wilcox, who rose to fame around the world thanks to her work as a singer and actress. She had sass, attitude, and a flair for style, which made her the perfect cover girl through much of the 80s. We caught up with Toya earlier to gain a little perspective on this unique time in history and in magazine publishing. Turn and go.
long before I had my first commercial hit, I was involved in the industry as a singer and writer. I was always known as Toya, but my career started in the punk era, and the first record I released was in 1977. And you needed magazine culture back then. There was the fanzine culture, as well as the culture of music magazines, which had incredible power. You had to be reviewed by music magazines to be on the map as an artist. So if fanzines took note of you, you knew that eventually music papers would take note of you as well. And not only did they have power, we respected them. We respected them for what articles they put in, for what fashions they followed, and for what names they recognized as being important names of the future as well as the present. On my death, it will be. My very first magazine cover was around 1978, I believe, and it was actually a cover in Yugoslavia. And I wasn't aware, but I had a big career in Yugoslavia, even though I never went there and I never worked there. And this was the first indication that my punk music was reaching far beyond the borders of Great Britain. But then I started to get covers like Record Mirror and eventually Smash Hits. But to get a front cover was just incredible, because in those days it meant that your face was on every newsstand in the UK, because these sold a lot of items. And a front cover was incredible recognition, because even if people didn't buy the magazine, they saw the magazines in newsstands. So on the street, you'd really made it if you were on a cover. It was quite phenomenal and so important as an artist to have that presence in print. I was never aware I was going to be on a front cover. I was never told. And the reason for this might purely have been that I was just too busy. So when front covers appeared, they'd either been pictures taken at a live show, and live shows were always nerve-wracking because the very front of the stage would be lined with 40 photographers and reviewers. So you knew you just had to be good that night. But you never knew where those pictures were going to go, and very rarely was I ever shown those pictures. Now, because of the internet, I get shown everything before it's published. But back then, I didn't quite know what was going to happen. So for me, a lot of the time, I'd be driving past on my way to a rock venue, and I'd see a newsagent on the street, and there was my picture on the front cover. I very rarely did an actual shoot for the front cover of any magazine, but otherwise, I had a PR person that managed everything for me, and she was the one who got the front covers. And the front covers were there because I was really, really popular. Sometimes it's so far away, sometimes it's very near. I shall be carried by the wind, just loud enough to hear. I feel this power within me, bells ringing in my head. If I was on a desert island, I would choose Smash Hits, because it was such an audience-friendly magazine. They printed our lyrics, which was incredibly important as a lyric writer for people to acknowledge lyrics, but also they were friendly to the artist. It was one of the few magazines that just didn't try to destroy the artist before they mentioned what the artist was doing. And if I was on a desert island, that's the kind of paper I would want with me.
That was Toya Wilcox. Tony Hearns, that's quite a fun question. What if you could have any era, any magazine, what would it be? Aside, we'll discount 2015, The Wire, of course. What would that be? Where would we go back to? 77, like some of what Toya Wilcox was talking about, or where would you start? Do you reckon?
Well, I'd like to say, I mean, obviously, you know, foundational experiences are the key ones, aren't they, when you're a blank slate, a tabula rasa and all that. And so they kind of, they stay with you longer than maybe what you read last week, possibly. So, I mean, yeah, certainly for me, The Enemy in particular in the late 1970s, mid-70s to late 1970s, was absolutely key. Yeah, it was The Ritual, The Thursday, the newspapers, the music papers would come out on a Thursday and you'd rush to the newsagent, you know. And there were three at the time, Enemy, Melody Maker and Sounds, and it was a bit like Levi and Wrangler jeans. You know, you wore one or the other, you didn't wear them both, and they were not interchangeable. And for me, it was The Enemy, and if The Enemy was not there and I had to buy Melody Maker or Sounds, it was absolutely distraught for that week. You know, what was I missing? So that period would be the one. But what's interesting, when you look at those papers from today, and the Wire office is near Spitalfields Market in East London, and basically every Thursday or Friday there's stalls there and they sell old copies of Enemy and so on and so forth from that period. And of course, in, you know, historically we've been told that that was a great period for Enemy. You had Charles Sean Murray, and then, you know, Paul Morley, Mick Farren, Ian MacDonald, and then Ian Penman, Julie Birchall, Tony Parsons, all these kind of legendary names were kind of like ripping up the rule book and turning The Enemy into this kind of astonishing mix of political diatribes, critical theory, etc., etc. But when you actually see those papers, it's quite shocking, because they're actually 90% of them are full of whatever was in the charts at the time, because these were weeklies, and so they had to fill up this space, you know. And maybe 10% was of the stuff that we may now remember as iconoclastic. So I would have those probably, but I would be probably profoundly disappointed in them.
That's a good sentiment. We can work with that sentiment. Andrew, what about you? What would yours be? Similar time?
For very similar reasons, I would be looking. You're quite right in saying that people tended to be either very much Enemy or Melody Maker people, although I am one of the few people who has actually written for both of them. But I was always very much a Melody Maker person. So, yeah, for me, for very similar reasons, it would be Melody Maker late 80s, from the time when I started reading it in, I guess, 1987-ish to the time, well, up until the time, basically, when they hired me and spoiled everything in mid-1989.
It was all downhill after that.
It clearly was. But that late period, late 80s Melody Maker. And you're also right in saying that when you look, nostalgia has a great way of tuning out the nonsense, really. Mm. So whenever people talk about great scenes of music, when people wax nostalgic about punk rock, everybody remembers, and quite rightly, The Clash, The Sex Pistols, The Damned. People forget the hundreds, thousands of other absolutely useless groups who all are now driving minicabs. But it is always the way. And when I look back through those old Melody Makers, as I believe we're about to
Why don't you kick off right now? Because you've got an invitingly, some sort of, you know, yellowed edge pages. Well, these are the sounds of the stack right here.
This is Melody Maker from October 28th, 1989, in which this is a time when I was still living in Australia, and I'm sure the reason I own this copy is I must have had a live review or something of somebody in there, because I used to send them reviews from Sydney and occasional features, which, oh, it's my review of U2 at the Sydney Entertainment Centre, in which I was incredibly rude about them.
some things don't change, Andrew.
That did change. They asked me to write the programme notes, or the sleeve notes, rather, for the last issue of Acton Baby. I sold out, basically, massively, is what happened. But yeah, Melody Maker used to be printed on beautiful, beautiful glossy paper in huge pages with lots and lots of photography. The features regularly running to 2,000 or 3,000 words, live reviews and album reviews up. The shortest live review is up around 300-400 words. This doesn't happen anymore. And there is, of course, now much more competition for people's time than there used to be. But weekly music papers used to kind of pride themselves on giving you a week's worth of stuff to read, because they knew, frankly, you had nothing else to be doing.
Well, I wonder, I mean, Tony, do you think there is a problem with patience, maybe? We talked about at the start about, you know, the onslaught of digital. Has it made... I mean, are you mindful of that? I don't know. You've got the Wire, of course, here. Are you mindful that people are maybe not as patient as they were?
No, I'm not, actually. I mean, we publish as much long-form writing as we can. You know, The Wire is a pagination of it. It may only be, you know, half the size of some magazines, but the work count will probably be twice as much, you know. Our features regularly run to 5,000-6,000 words. Most of our reviews are like 300-400 words. Mm-hmm. Whereas
that's all very unusual now, though.
It is, and that's what I find it difficult to understand. I mean, you know, if we talk about the mainstream magazines now, Mojo and Uncut are the more obvious ones in the UK. You know, and I have respect. And I know people who work for both. I have respect for both of those magazines to a certain extent, but. I get frustrated because I want to read Mojo critics writing at length on the subjects that they're asked to write on, and because there are still some fantastic writers who work for those magazines, and a lot of them actually also write for The Wire.
I don't know, is this the new latest issue of The Wire?
So talk to us
a little bit about this. I don't know, leaf through and maybe pick out a couple of examples of why you've got that commitment, why that's important to you, and what it means you can do. When you take a more considered view.
Well, The Wire, I mean, the totality of The Wire. I mean, obviously, this is going to sound like special pleading, isn't it? Obviously, I'm going to big up The Wire.
Right.
Free to take it all with a pinch of salt. But I'll try and be honest about it, you know, because we are honest, you know. I mean, The Wire, you know, each issue is both, you know, the totality of each issue is what it's about, you know. The Wire is about... It's very difficult to talk about what The Wire is about, actually. Obviously, you could easily represent magazines like Mojo or Uncut, or even Melody Maker and NME back in the day, or even Smash Hits, as Toya mentioned, or The Face later on. But with The Wire, it's a bit difficult. You know, you could talk about it. It's a magazine about underground music, experimental music, left field, alternative, or whatever. But, you know, we also like, I don't know, Iggy Pop or Bob Dylan or, you know, stuff like that, which absolutely is not underground or experimental or left field particularly. So it's about music that may have a certain attitude, a certain, I'm reluctant to use this word, authenticity of expression, that music that may exist out of some kind of necessity rather than out of, you know, ego or money or whatever. So, but all these things sound a bit pompous when I say it, really. So this issue, for instance, yeah, so on the cover there's Mika Levy, who is a kind of classic sort of figure in the Wire world. You know, she works in all kind of areas. She was schooled at the Guildhall School of Music, I think it was. She works with the London Sinfonietta. She writes string quartets, but she also works with local East London rappers and making mixtapes for Fact and working with grime producers and all this kind of stuff. And of course, she recently soundtracked Under the Skin, which recently won her European Film Award and a BAFTA nomination, sadly not an Oscar. But anyway, so she's on the cover, and she's a kind of a bit of a typical example of not just how music magazines have changed, but how music itself has changed, how musicians operate more as kind of, to quote Toya's husband, Robert Fripp, mobile, flexible units or something like that, you know, not pinned down to particular group formations, labels, particular relationships, very fluid, moving around, mostly like most people do in general. And so lots of the people, we very rarely write about groups in The Wire these days. It's very peculiar. Most of the people we write about are individuals who form into groups and then break away and do other things. And
that doesn't surprise me necessarily, just thinking out loud, in that the economics and logistics of keeping a group together now are murderous, basically, and almost impossible, certainly on a full-time level.
Yeah. And also most of the musicians in The Wire, they're not really signed up to labels. Those kind of arrangements don't exist. You know, labels will put music out by them, very often in vinyl editions, cassette editions, and so on. You know, the CD is kind of dead as far as that area is concerned. But at the same time, they're on SoundCloud, they're on MixCloud, they're on Bandcamp. So it's doing the same thing, a bit like a magazine like The Wire. You know, we publish a print edition, but obviously we do also a digital edition, and we're online and so on. But it's very difficult to talk about the decisions we make. Again, it's very gut instinct. If it feels right, basically we do something, you know.
So that's a pretty robust reason to make the editorial.
I think it's a good one.
I think it's a good one,
you know. And I think it's about putting trust in the opinions of either the people who work in the office or the writers that contribute and so on and so forth, you know, that they get what the magazine's about and they kind of know what's right.
Andrew, I know you got a stack of other things appropriately on the stack. Maybe, talk us through something else. Whether we look at how... A bit on maybe how, I don't know, how the NME has changed from the one have there to the one that's on the left. Paint us a potted history of how it's got from one to the other.
The
perhaps.
Copy of the NME I've bought in, this was during my brief and largely unhappy period working there. Like I said, once a Melody Maker person, always a Melody Maker person. But I bought this in because I contributed absolutely nothing to this issue. But though it pains me to admit it, as a Melody Maker person, I think this is the best music press front page of the 1990s and one of the best... ever, which showed what the weekly music press used to do well. This was the one they put out very, very quickly on almost no notice after news of Kurt Cobain's suicide in April 1994. And as you can see, they went with very simple shot, Martin Goodacre's portrait of Kurt Cobain staring straight into the lens from mascara-smeared eyes underneath a manky fringe. To be honest, I think actually even putting his name and date of birth and death on the bottom is overselling it. Had anybody asked me, not that they did, I just would have gone with the plain cover. But I think it is a beautiful and enduring cover. And also at the time, one of the reasons it was important was that this was about the last time it felt like any kind of counterculture existed, which is another thing which is told against the music press. Almost no newspapers, grown-up newspapers, reported Kurt Cobain's death for days. They simply did not understand what had happened or that this was actually a story. Famously, The Guardian ran a very small obituary beneath that of Dan Hartman, best remembered for the novelty disco hit Instant Replay. It felt like this was a story that was a huge story that only we, that is the kind of people who read the music press, understood. And the NME absolutely nailed it with that. It's such a great cover, and the content inside, which I know for a fact they threw together in nothing flat. I think they did an amazing job that week. This is the NME now, which I bought on the way in here. I'll return to my earlier caveat. This shouldn't make any sense to me. I'm you know, like I said, I'm 46 years old. I'm not interested in the music papers, except rather disturbingly, it actually makes quite a lot of sense to me, because leaving aside Peace, the somewhat hapless indie group they've put on the cover, all the other features, there's a huge piece on Nick Cave's Murder Ballads album, which is about 25 years old, it's not that old, 20 years old, a big piece on the Smiths' Meet His Murder Turns 30. And it's a great album. My point is that the year that Meet His Murder came out, the NME was not doing top corner drop-ins on, you know, Bill Haley and the Comets rediscovered. This is another problem I think the music press has. And again, all due acknowledgement that I'm a middle-aged man, rock and roll has kind of run out of steam in terms of places it can go artistically, places it can go politically, the degree to which it's still capable of upsetting anybody and seeming shocking. It simply isn't. But again, when you actually look even 20 years later at the size of NME in the 1990s, the length of the reviews, the length of the features versus what's there now, I mean, of the current issue of the NME, I'm pretty sure I could get from the back front cover to the back in less time than it takes me to get the tube home. And that's only if the crossword's difficult.
Tony, last word to you. Andrew Muller says rock's run out of steam. I know it's not really specifically a publishing point, but
rock and roll is dead. Long live rock.
Whatever, just as a final note, I mean, are you fairly optimistic then? I mean, I get the impression from, you know, talking to you today that, you know, there's still a lot that you're very optimistic about, a lot that you're very confident about in terms of editorial direction, the opportunities that are there in printed music media. Is that fair, or is there causes for concern perhaps as well?
There's huge amounts of activity and music being made away from what we have to call the mainstream, you know, and we have to remember that the relationship between underground or the counterculture and mainstream culture now is completely severed in a way. You know, there's very little, whereas back in the day, you know, even back in the 90s, there was one. The counterculture and the mainstream had some kind of weird sort of symbiotic to and fro, and that has definitely stopped. But there are still vast, you would not believe the amount of music that is happening. You know, it's happening in tiny, out of the way places made by young people deploying peculiar instruments, electronics and so on, down on their knees in a basement or something, surrounded by their peers. And these people are also makers. You know, they make stuff, they put out their own stuff. You know, it may not feel has the potential for revolution that punk rock had. It was not a mass movement, but, you know, we've had mass movements in music over the since rock and roll, and where has it got us? It's got us nowhere. So let's forget the idea that rock is revolutionary, because it's a joke, it's a fallacy. You know, punk rock changed nothing, grunge changed nothing. Take a look around you if you think that was the otherwise. But there are still these people in their tiny little cells making stuff. And as long as people make stuff, you need someone, people who have intelligence and opinion, to interpret it. And there will always be people who want to read interpretations of this stuff, not just because they're a part of it. I'm not a part of this scene. I'm like, you know, 30 to 35 years older than most of the people involved in it. But I'm interested in it, and I'm interested in reading about it, and I'm interested in being told about it, either positively, negatively, provocatively, or whatever. So yeah, absolutely. As long as activity, like, as long as music happens, then there's going to be a call for writing which responds to it in some way. And how that, whether that will be online, in books, in magazines, periodicals, journals, whatever, you know, those kind of things will all probably exist together. But absolutely, you know, if you take notice of this stuff, it's really still a quite exciting stuff coming out. What am I saying? Quite exciting. It's very exciting. Let's not beat around the bush.
That's good. So, that's a good note to end on. It's very, very exciting. The insights there of Tony Harrington, editor-in-chief of The Wire, and of my other guest, the music journalist and author Andrew Muller of
It's Too Late to Die Young Now, which does touch quite extensively on a lot of the stuff we've been talking about. Thank you for the plug.
In all good bookstores now. Tony, Andrew, thank you both very much indeed for joining us on The Stack. And that does indeed bring us to the end of this 128th edition of The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. Thanks once again to my guests, Tony Harrington and Andrew Muller. Our producer today was David Pleasant and our studio manager was Claire Urban. Any comments or queries, drop us a note at info@monocle.com and don't forget to tune in again next Saturday at the very same time. You can always listen again at monocle.com or via iTunes or SoundCloud. But for now, from me and the team, that's all we've got time for. Goodbye.